This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and this is Free Thought Radio, where anything goes.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. This is the weekend of January the 14th and 15th, 2012. Free Thought Radio broadcast in Madison, Wisconsin. And hello to all you podcast listeners and those who are listening to the broadcasts in Grand Rapids, in Monterey, in New York City, where we just were, which we'll talk about in just a minute, and in Milwaukee.
Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which is a nonprofit, and that's both spellings, both nonprofit as in educational, and nonprofit without religion, P-R-O-P-H-E-T. We're the nation's largest association of freethinkers.
And freethinkers means atheists, agnostics, apatheists, I guess that's a word, polyatheists, and the non-religious. Well, whatever you call yourself, we like to say that we freethinkers all disbelieve in the same gods.
FFRF is also a vigilant state church watchdog with four staff attorneys. We also litigate. We've taken more than 50 lawsuits in the past 30-some years, and we have six active lawsuits going as we speak.
Our guest on the second half of today's show will be John Compeer. He joins the very exclusive circle of former ministers who, like myself, are now non-believers. And he's also a member of the Clergy Project, which we've talked about before, a new organization of former and active clergy, ministers, priests, missionaries, a few rabbis.
A nun, don't you have?
Yeah, there's two nuns, actually, one from Maine and another one just joining, who used to believe, who used to practice, who were ordained practicing clergy of some form, who are now atheists or agnostics. And we've talked about it before, Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and Linda LaScola and myself and Robin Cornwell and others have started this organization. And John Compeer is a former Southern Baptist preacher himself, and he's going to tell us about his story and about his position now as one of the lead screeners for the Clergy Project.
So the Clergy Project is a support group for ministers who are in the closet needing to come out.
Right.
Isn't that right?
Right.
And he's also a fifth-generation Baptist minister, was ordained a Southern Baptist minister at the age of 18, and he's going to tell us why he left the ministry in his early 30s and what he's been doing ever since to pay penance.
It's kind of like my story. There's a lot of parallels there, so it'll be fun to talk to John.
So, Dan, you and I just got back from a whirlwind three-day vacation in New York City, and it seems wherever we go, we are celebrating free thought.
Well, you know that old Christian song? Maybe you don't because you weren't raised in church. I walk today where Jesus walked.
No, I don't know that song.
It's about a Christian who goes to Israel, to Jerusalem, and then he's, you know, reliving all these places in the Bible. Well, when I go to New York City, I feel like singing I Walk Today Where Irving Berlin Walked and George Gershwin and Jerome Kern and Richard Rodgers and Yip Harburg and the Burton Lane and Jay Gorney, all these well-known composers of movies and Broadway musicals and popular songs who were freethinkers, who did not believe in God. And having read a lot of their biographies, when I walk down the streets again, I think, this is the street where Jerome Kern made his last walk in his life. And this is the theater where Richard Rodgers performed this musical.
And so many of the theaters are now named for these composers and lyricists.
Well, we went to the Richard Rodgers Theater to see Porgy and Bess this last week.
Which is a controversial play because, well, it turns out we got cheated. It's a four-hour opera, and it was down to 2.5 hours, but beautiful music.
Oh, it was
beautiful
fun.
Performers.
We noticed they had to trim some of the lyrics, and Sondheim, of course, was complaining about that. You know, he would have wanted the whole 4 hour.
Well, they rewrote the book, and yeah. I need to go back and look. But the music stands up to all of that.
By George and Ira Gershwin. It Ain't Necessarily So, which is one of the songs we play a lot on this show.
Which we noticed got pruned of a one verse, we think.
Yeah, verse about Moses. Yeah.
That was odd. I mean, they must have cut a lot of things to make it so short. But performers are wonderful.
Well, very powerful. And it was sad thinking that when George Gershwin died of the brain tumor at age 39, at that time, Porgy and Bess was a flop. He had put so much time and energy into this musical, and people were criticizing him, saying, what does this New York City street kid know about writing opera, you know? And if only he could have known how that legacy has endured.
And then we also saw, for fun, we saw Anything Goes.
The Cole Porter, a revival of the Cole Porter musical, Anything Goes.
With great standards, and that's a great revival. It's campy. It's like an ode to 30s Broadway musicals and Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers dancing, that kind of thing. It was very well done.
Well, and Anything Goes was written by the gay atheist Cole Porter, who had to come out of two closets.
And Anything Goes has some kind of free-thinking lyrics.
And there are other types. You know, a lot of his songs were a direct rebuke to the censors of his day. And I noticed during this revival that they put some words back in that he had to take out. There's a line in that song, You'd Be So Easy to Love. His original lyrics were, you'd be so nice to awaken with, so nice to have eggs and bacon with, which he had to change to you're so worth the yearning for, to keep every home fires burning for. Well, they put both versions in the current one.
Which is very nice. And I noticed how cute those lyrics were. I mean, they shouted out.
Well, that was the high point for me, was sitting there listening to Cole Porter's lyrics. And, you know, I'd never actually seen the musical. It was quite a romp. It was pretty silly, I mean.
With Joel Grey.
Joel Grey was playing this con man dressed up like a preacher.
And there was a sort of free thought little thing there. The ministers weren't who they seemed to be.
Yeah, and these Chinese guys who were pretending to be converted to Christianity who actually weren't.
Then we were staying near Library Way, and I was noticing, which is they have these golden plaques in the sidewalk with quotes or paragraphs from many great literature, because it's leading up to the public library.
That's 42nd,
41st
Street.
On 41st Street.
Yeah.
And I noticed it seemed like everyone or every other one was a free-thinking author. I mean, amazing. The contributions, not just musical, but literature.
Well, then you walk into the library there and you see Andrew Carnegie's name as one of the benefactors for
that. Well, he was the person who's more responsible for more public libraries than anybody else, and he was an atheist.
And I bought a refrigerator magnet there with an Einstein quote, a prejudice is harder to crack than an atom.
And there's another good atheist. Yeah. So, well, it was a great weekend. And now on to the news portion of this broadcast.
The Freedom From Religion Foundation's first Billboard of the Year of 2012, which says, keep religion out of politics, made breaking news in the Providence Journal last week. Our 14-by-48-foot bulletin billboard, part of our national advertising campaign, went up in the new year in Warwick, Rhode Island.
And of course, it's our election year caveat to keep religion out of politics. But the message has special meaning in the state of Rhode Island, after all, because it was founded by Roger Williams, a strong advocate of keeping religion and government separate. This is the first billboard that we have placed in Rhode Island. And the Providence, Rhode Island, Providence newspaper also pointed out that FFRF has awarded its Thomas Jefferson Youth Activist Award to a Rhode Islander, Jessica Alquist, the 16-year-old who we've had on our show, who is the Cranston West High School student who is suing her school over an unlawful prayer banner at her school. She lives in that area.
Our newest lawsuit of the year, FFRF versus Jan Brewer, also got pressed. The Arizona Republic reported that we filed the lawsuit in state court, Maricopa County Superior Court, a week ago Wednesday. And as Annie Laurie told the Arizona Republic, we mean business. We do not think the governor has the right or the authority under the state constitution to exhort citizens to pray, much less set aside an entire day to prayer. She's also demonstrated other inappropriate overreaches of her office by asking people to pray about the budget, which we think is a little ridiculous. Annie Laurie then accused Governor Brewer of using her office to promote her own religious point of view. and pointed out that the news lawsuit was brought not just by atheists, but by atheists, Christians, Muslims, and Buddhists.
And we do want to thank those local plaintiffs, all important, and our attorneys, Richard Morris and Mark Victor of the Phoenix area, for their very wonderful pro bono representation.
Now, the nicest news to report today, we're still mopping up over nativity scene violations around the country. We had a solid victory in Elwood City, Pennsylvania, where 400 or 500 people, I think the news said it was almost 1,000, turned up to demonstrate against FFRF's complaint over the city-sponsored nativity scene by the entrance of their city hall. But reason had prevailed. Rather than accept FFRF's winter solstice display, the city borough voted that this year they simply won't return the nativity display. The mayor, however, who did not have a vote on it, has continued to try to stir up trouble. He's asked the city to reconsider earlier this week. Although hundreds turned up to support Christianity in government at that hearing on Monday night, the borough did not revisit the issue. So it looks like we still have a solid First Amendment victory.
And it's gotten a lot of play. Here is one of the two news stations that covered this non-vote in favor of keeping the creche off city property.
Remember this? This was about a month ago in Elwood City, the street in front of the municipal building filled with people singing Christmas carols, holding signs and crosses, standing in support of a nativity scene that's been in that community for decades. Tonight, the battle is far from over. Supporters with signs and t-shirts jammed a meeting to demand the borough council change its mind about a recent decision. David Highfield has the story from Elwood City.
It was last month when Elwood City Council voted to move this nativity scene off municipal property. They said it was to avoid a lawsuit from a group from Wisconsin. Well, tonight, people packed a meeting to ask council to reconsider.
We have a right to believe in what we believe in. They have a right not to believe in God. It's their privilege. If they want to go to hell, they can go. I'll help send them.
Some people had signs, others wore t-shirts that read, God belongs in my city. Many asked council to take another vote and keep the nativity where it's been for the past 50 years, rather than cower from a possible legal fight.
This is not a town to back down from a push come to shove situation.
I'm asking you, please consider fighting for this. Your town wants it.
How long will it be before we can no longer ring church bells? Before we can no longer have a cross on top of our church.
This all started with a complaint from the Freedom from Religion Foundation. And not everyone here disagreed with its point. Bill Kozicki traveled from Elizabeth because he says this is a hot button issue for him.
I don't give a damn where they put it, as long as it's not on government property. They can double the size of it and put it across the street. That's fine.
He was quickly challenged.
And if you work on Christmas Day, do you take Christmas pay?
By nearly everyone around him.
I hope you take air conditioning with you where you go, where you want to go.
You have evidence of that?
In the end, council did not schedule a revote, but the mayor has faith.
Through some more lobbying that we can get the votes to have council overturned our decision previously.
While the question of where this nativity should go is not on the agenda for next week's council meeting yet, the mayor believes by the time next Monday rolls around, it will be. In Elwood City, David Highfield, KDKA TV News.
So we're still hanging in there with that, but amazing.
And that was one of our members. Did you know that? Bill Kozicki was his name, who showed up to help speak for reason, and they told him, you're going to need an air conditioner where you're going.
Can you imagine the ignorance, the bellicosity of that meeting? Well, I'm Annie Laurie.
And I'm Dan Barker.
And coming up, we are going to have an ode to non-believers in
well,
the next segment.
To preachers who have lost their faith.
And then we're going to be talking with John Compierre, who is a fifth-generation Southern Baptist preacher who gave it up at 32, has seen the light, and be interesting to find out his story.
If they want to go to hell, they can go. I'll help send them.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
Hey and anything goes. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We were talking about the atheist Cole Porter. And now we'd like to play, Dan, the first song you wrote in 19... This was just after you left the ministry, had openly become an atheist. What year?
Well, 1984 is when I announced it.
And it's called Blood Brothers.
When I was 4 years old, I had a little friend named Joshua. Whenever I was alone, he would come over to play. Cookies, cartoons, and punch. He liked all the same things that I liked. Cheerios and milk for lunch. Kitty cats, balloons, and kites. We were blood brothers, pals forever. We were as close as we could be. Nobody else could see him, but he was real to me. Sometimes when I was sad, I would send Joshua a letter. He never wrote me back, but he'd always come right over to play. I never been to his house, but I knew exactly where he lived. His mommy and daddy were so nice. They would let us have fun every day. We were blood brothers, pals forever. We were as close as we could be. Nobody else could see him, but he was real to me. When I was 5 years old, I just got so busy with schoolwork. Many new friends to get to know. Joshua moved away. Sometimes I miss him so. We had such good times together. But I know he had to go. Sometimes just works out that way. We were blood brothers, pals forever. He was my very best friend. Nobody else could see him. I know he was just pretend. Now that some years have passed, I can look back and smile at my childhood, at the times when it hurt to grow up, like when Joshua moved away.
That's Dan Barker's first Free Thought song, Blood Brothers. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
I'm Dan Barker. Coming up, we'll talk with another former minister who had the exact same experience. He's a former Southern Baptist preacher named John Compeer. Stay tuned for a riveting story.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And we have on the phone with us today from the Phoenix area, John Compeer. His book is called Towards the Light, and it's a story about how he saw the light after many years as a Southern Baptist preacher. John tells a story of deconversion, and John and I have been working with the Clergy Project, which we've talked about on this show a number of times, a project which now has more than 130 people in it, which is helping ministers, priests, rabbis, clergy who are still in the pulpit but want to get out. And John, as a former preacher himself, understands those struggles. And so, well, welcome to Free Thought Radio, John.
Thank you so much, Dan. I'm delighted to be here.
Did I say your name right? Compeer?
You said it right, my friend. You're great.
Some people say Compeer, but it's Compeer.
It's Compeer, however. In French, it would be Compère, but you sort of got to clear your throat while you say that.
Well, I just have to say that hearing your voice, you just sound like the authentic Southern Baptist preacher. You just have that something about it, that authenticity.
If I wasn't authentic, then nobody is, because as you know, I was fifth-generation Baptist minister. My great-great-grandparents came to these shores as missionary to the Creek Indians, and then I was fifth-generation in that. So I was indeed authentic. It's just that I couldn't stay in the ministry.
So were the eldest son expected to become a minister in your family?
Well, I was the youngest son. But I was the one who had the most proclivity for that. I was a natural-born ham and began preaching long before I had anything to say.
Well, like Dan, you started preaching at 15.
I did.
Yeah, I remember
that. I think my first sermon was on something like the meaning of love, God, and the universe, some small subject that I knew a lot about.
Yeah, 15-year-olds don't understand all that. I remember standing
right.
I stood up before congregations, and they thought, I guess if you're called by God, you must be saying something important. But
oh, absolutely. Well, they need to believe. They want to believe. So we helped them do that. Back then we did.
Now, I need to ask you, did you really, really believe it? Did you feel it, or were you just doing it because you felt like you had to?
Dan and Annie Laurie, religious faith was not something I did. It was something I was. The air I breathed, the water I drank, everything was the church and religion. It was all I knew, and it was everything I believed. So until I began having doubts when I was in college, I didn't have one slight iota of doubt that it was all true and that everything else was not true.
Now, you were ordained a Southern Baptist minister very early. You were 18, but you did go to a seminary, is that right?
Yes, I did. I was 18 and ordained when I was a sophomore in college and began serving a country church, which I did throughout my college career and indeed served churches while I was in seminary. But I went to what was at the time, because I had begun having doubts in college after I was ordained and serving a church, I went to what was at the time the most liberal of the Southern Baptist seminaries. It was in the town of Wake Forest, North Carolina, where the Wake Forest College had been until the R.J. Reynolds Foundation gave them a ton of money and they moved to Winston-Salem. So the Southern Baptist Convention created a seminary on the old Wake Forest campus in the town of Wake Forest, north of Raleigh. And it had a liberal president, and he brought in the most liberal of his friends to be on the faculty. So I went there hoping I could get some answers to my questions. It hasn't stayed liberal because the fundamentalists took over the board of directors and it became quite conservative like the other Southern Baptist groups. But at the time I went there, it was rather liberal.
And when did you got a seminary degree? When did you graduate?
I graduated in 1961.
Now, in your book... Oh, go ahead.
I was, at the time I was in seminary, it took me 3.5 years instead of 3 because I also had to work. I was married and had a daughter, and so I was the associate minister of the Wake Forest Baptist Church, which was there on campus and had the children of most of my seminary professors in the youth programs that I ran.
And then you were called I like that joke you tell in your book about what is it? The joke about how when a large wealthy church invites a minister to preach, yeah. the minister is downstairs praying while his wife is right. upstairs packing.
That's right. It's supposed to be that the Holy Spirit leads the church to the minister and leads the minister to the church. But in my experience, if it's a nice plum position, the minister's downstairs praying and the wife is upstairs packing.
But you didn't. You went to like a small little country church then.
I didn't. I had, Dan, I had come to the conclusion that I simply, because of all the reading that I was doing and trying to talk to my professors, mostly not getting adequate answers, I had come to the conclusion that I didn't think this was true, but I couldn't stand the thought of breaking my parents' heart. They were lovely people. I didn't share their faith anymore, but I honored their faith. And so I decided that I would play it pure. I would not ask somebody to recommend me to a nice church. And so when I finished seminary, although I'd had a good record and had preached in the campus church on a number of occasions, I didn't have a place to go. So I just returned home and waited for the Holy Spirit to lead. And what ended up happening was that one of my seminary professors was filling in at a little small country church in North Carolina and thought of me and gave them my name. And so they contacted me, and I went there and served as their minister.
So you were having doubts as early as seminary. So through
I was
much...
having doubts actually as early as college.
Wow. So
I was a sophomore. I was already ordained and had a church, but I had been asked by a friend of my father's to come fill in for him in the First Baptist Church of, I won't name the city, but one of the large places in Mississippi. Great, big, wonderful thing for a little 18-year-old preacher boy to do. So I was in the study, pacing back and forth, saying my sermon out loud before going into the auditorium to preach it. And I said something out loud about how everybody who hasn't accepted Jesus is doomed to an eternity of punishment. And all of a sudden, I stopped and asked myself, can that possibly be true?
Or could it unbidden? Be nice?
unbidden. But I said, oh, I can't think that. I've got to go deliver this sermon. So I stuffed it back, went in and gave them my best shtick. And then after having the evening service, which in Southern Baptist circles you got to have, not many people come, but you got to have it. And on my way back to the college campus, the question began to arise again. How could that possibly be true? So from that point on, I was seeking. I just didn't get any decent answers from the people I talked to. In fact, to summarize the answers I got from the religious professionals, it was, go ahead and kick the rock, John, and by the time you're finished kicking it, you'll know it's the rock of ages.
So just have faith no matter what.
Now, that's right.
When you were troubled by this, I mean, I'm assuming part of this was, I mean, this idea of people being tortured eternally just because they didn't believe in Jesus. Is that right?
Right. That's where it began. But then it went from there to everything else that I now know to be the fiction of the faith.
One of the other Clergy Project ministers jokingly says, thank God for hell. That's what made
right.
me That's what made me an atheist.
That's absolutely right.
I love this line in your book. You write, the average parishioner would be thunderstruck to know how many ministers actually believe half of what they preach.
That's absolutely correct. I don't have any statistics on that. And as a scientist, I have to be clear when I'm just making a swag, yeah. a scientific wild-ass guess. But your experience, I'm sure, is like mine, that many and many an ordained minister does not believe most of what their congregation thinks they believe, and thus they become publicly phony and privately cynical. And I thought, that is a lousy way to live your life.
Well, okay, and that is true, and that's true with me, but for the first two-thirds or 80% of my ministry, I really did believe until I started going through that process. So I started out sincere, and I think most clergy do. I think they start
so do
out, I think they start out sincere with a few exceptions, and then they start learning. They start learning
That's
too
right.
much.
That's absolutely right. They start out really wanting to try to make the world a better place, and believing that the message they have been told is actually true. So they're quite sincere, and then if they begin to think for themselves and read things like your wonderful books, they begin to come to a different conclusion, and most of them don't know where to turn. That's what I was just, you were talking about the clergy project. Just this morning, I have been on the phone an hour each with two separate active ministers who are wondering, what do I do? I know now that I don't think what I've been teaching people and preaching is true, but what do I do? In one case, the person says, my wife is still a very firm, true believer. And if she found out about this, it would be Katie bar the door.
Yeah.
And how do I make a living? How do these skills transfer? You know that agony because you're the one who, along with Richard Dawkins and Dan Dennett, got this project started, Dan.
Well, let's talk some more about that when we come back from the break. We're talking with John Compeer, a former Southern Baptist minister, whose book is called Towards the Light. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And let's give that subtitle of his book. It's A Fifth Generation Baptist Minister's Journey from Religion to Reason.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
And the superstitious monkey is off the back of our guest, John Compeer, a former fifth-generation Southern Baptist minister. I'm Dan Barker here with Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we learned from John that he went on after leaving the ministry to get his Ph.D. in clinical psychology. So, John, you still really have a heart for helping people, is that right?
I do, Dan. I'm just a born rescuer. And I couldn't imagine doing something that wasn't a part of trying to make life a little bit easier because life is so unfair to so many people. And so that's what I did.
Now,
I was living in Winston-Salem where Wake Forest University had moved. And so I simply traveled across town during the last year that I was in the ministry to take some undergraduate courses in psychology because when I went to college to begin with, I majored in English and Bible. So I didn't have much psychology background, though I had done pastoral psychology. And then I resigned my church without telling them I was no longer a believer. I don't know whether that was the right thing to do or not, but that's what I did.
It was practical.
It was practical, and I just said, I want to go on to get more training in psychology and be a professional psychologist. So I just traveled across town then after I resigned my pastorate in 1967 and got my master's in psychology. And then I commuted back and forth to Chapel Hill for 3 years to get my Ph.D. in clinical psychology and then stayed on in town to teach at Wake Forest University and medical school and had a practice, and then eventually consulting and went into public speaking professionally.
Now, John, the last segment we heard all about you're starting to have doubts, but what was the catalyst or what catapulted you out of the ministry and back into school?
There was no single one thing, Annie Laurie. It's just 3 years before I finally left, and I left in 67, so I guess that would have been in 64, I had a long talk with self and took a look at everything I could find and said, you know, this just doesn't make sense. The evidence is just not there. Now, there were no good books like your books, Dan, or Dawkins' books or others at that time. The only thing I could read that helped me was a book by Leslie Weatherhead, an English minister who was quite liberal, who I'm sure you remember the little monograph he wrote called The Will of God, in which he tried to explain how there was the permissive will and all this other stuff. But he wrote a book called The Christian Agnostic, in which he defined a Christian agnostic as one who was attracted to the Christ myth and who said about those things that had validated themselves in his experience, that I can believe, but about all the rest of the tenets of the faith that had not validated themselves in his experience, I will put that in a mental drawer labeled Awaiting Further Light, which is where the title of my book comes from, Toward the Light. And so I kept trying to put things in that mental drawer. The drawer just kept getting crammed full because there was a whole lot more I didn't believe than I did. And one of the last sermons I delivered in that church, I was talking about what might happen after death, if anything, and said, if there is a hell, I want to go there. Because I don't want to spend an eternity with an all-powerful, omnipotent being who would create such a monstrosity.
Exactly.
Well, did you get any gasps from the audience?
I got gasps from the audience. But, Annie Laurie, you know, people don't really care what the minister says very much. They just don't want to be bored. And I was not boring, and the church was growing, and money was coming in, so they said, what the hey? That's just John being John.
You write in your book, the church was growing, and I was something of a local celebrity, but I was dying inside. I didn't want to end up like so many ministers who were publicly phony but privately cynical. So with you, it was a real issue of integrity.
It absolutely was. I did not want to hurt my parents or my friends. And all, as you know, Dan, all of my friends were ministers or church people. All of my relationships were. In both my mother's and my father's family, they were just ministers out there, yin-yang. And my mother and father were lovely people, very sincere, genuine people. And in fact, I mean, and I didn't want to hurt them. I knew it would break their heart. And I tried so hard to stay in the ministry with integrity, but just couldn't, and finally didn't. But you might find this interesting. Even though they knew when they died, each of them 10, 11 years ago at age 92, that I no longer believed, each of them asked me to deliver the eulogy at their funeral because they said, nobody else understands who we are the way you do. So I did. Not because I believed that, but I honored their faith.
John, what about your wife? Was she a devout Christian? And did
you? She was.
So how did she... Did you share your doubts?
Yes, and she was willing to go along for a while. When I went back to school for 5 years, she was working on the Wake Forest campus to help pay the bills, and we stayed together for 3 years after I got my Ph.D., but we were involved in the marriage enrichment movement that David and Vera Mace began, and we learned to do some really good communicating, and it became clear that the person I had become was not the person she thought she was married to. And I say in my book, she was the perfect minister's wife. Unfortunately, she wasn't married to the perfect minister. So our marriage came to an end, but we've stayed very good friends. And in fact, a year and a half ago, my current wife and I went with all of our children and grandchildren on a vacation with my ex-wife and my ex-mother-in-law. So it's
well, that's a very nice testament.
It's a testament to friendship, whatever the situation. Now, we're almost out of time. I want to thank you for helping so much with this clergy project. It started out small, but now it's grown to be something almost too huge to handle. We've had to increase the screening. And, John, you have stepped in and taken a bit of the lead, especially this last month, in screening new members of the clergy project. Tell us a little bit more about what that is like.
Okay, it's a wonderful experience. We have had, in the last 5 weeks, we've had 22 candidates make application to join the clergy project. I have been able to talk with 18 of them. And most of them, some of them are no longer in the ministry, and about a third of them are still current ministers. And they tell the same story that we would understand, which is, I don't know what to do. This is how I make my living. How will I pay my bills? And also some of them say, as you know, my wife is still a very ardent believer, One of them just recently, who joined our group, said that when it became clear that he is no longer a believer, she said, "You will have to move out because I cannot be unequally yoked."
Yeah, there's that Bible verse.
That's right.
Or my husband. We have a few female ministers in the group, too.
Yes, we do. Yes, indeed, we do. In fact, we just admitted one recently that you know about, Dan, who was as much a minister as her husband. She just wasn't ordained.
Well, thank you much, John Compeer.
Compeer.
Mm-hmm. Your book is called Towards the Light, A Fifth Generation Baptist Minister's Journey from Religion to Reason. And how can people find that?
It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and both in ebook as well as in hardcover.
The Clergy Project is at clergyproject.org. Thank you, John, and thank you, Dave, for producing, and thank you, Buzz Kemper, for announcing. This show is produced in Madison, Wisconsin. Go to ffrf.org/radio for details.
Ask for more information or join us at ffrf.org. You can also leave your name and address at 1-800-335-4021. We hope you will join us and tune in next week for more Rational Radio and Blasphemous Broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker. I hope someday.